We're discussing Russia's information war on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 3.5 million Ukrainians have fled across their borders since Russia started its invasion nearly a month ago. That is from the UN Refugee Agency's data portal. As Ukrainians deal with the devastation of their homeland, the Kremlin is trying to shape global opinion and spread lies about its invasion. Do you have family members in Russia who have bought into the Kremlin's messaging? Are you concerned that something you read online is actually propaganda? Are you worried about journalism that sows skepticism and suspicion toward Ukraine? 800-642-1234. Anton Shirikov is a PhD researcher at UW-Madison, focusing on misinformation, propaganda, and mechanisms of authoritarian rule in Russia. Anton, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, can we start by exploring your own conversations with loved ones? You have family in Russia. You have asked them about Russia's invasion and war-torn Ukraine. What have you heard from people in your own life?
Yes, this is a hard topic for many people. So there are two kinds of responses, I would say. One response is people understand that this is a war. And this is an unprovoked aggression by Russia. And some of them are definitely against it. But they're also afraid to discuss it in detail because, as you know, recently it's been criminalized in Russia to talk about war, to talk about the losses of the Russian army, and to support Ukraine in this conflict. And then, and so they are trying to be very cautious. And then the other group, I would say, they are supportive of this, and they basically buy into what propaganda is saying, that this is a liberation war, not a war, according to the government. This is a campaign to liberate Ukraine from Nazis, and that we should do this because we need to help people who are stranded there.
Russian authorities have restricted access to news publications, BBC, BBC Russia, Radio Liberty, a Latvia publication earlier this month. CNN stopped broadcasting there. Bloomberg News stopped or suspended. Mm-hmm. What media are the Russian people commonly consuming?
So this has not changed since from before the invasion. Most Russians are getting the news from state television, and even if they don't watch television, they still are very likely to get the news from state-controlled news outlets online. And right now, it changed in the sense that even fewer people read independent or watch independent media in Russia. But some of them are trying to use VPNs and other technical means to access those independent media. Some of these media stopped working completely or almost stopped working because they are just cut off their advertising and subscribers in Russia. I would say most people are still in this bubble of propaganda. Some people are trying to get access to independent media with
virtual private networks, VPNs.
Yes. Right.
Well, along those lines, Axios is reporting this morning that Radio Free Europe and Reporters Without Borders, they've been mirroring websites for news sites that are being censored, so making exact copies of them at new internet addresses as kind of this workaround to reach Russians. Do you think that there will be stepped up efforts to get around the censorship?
I hope so. I think that the main problem here is not even technical, because even with Facebook, which is blocked in Russia, I think many millions of people are still using it, using VPNs, or sometimes it's not even blocked because they lack technical capacity to do so in the whole of Russia right now. So I think helping people to get access is good, but I think at the same time, the main problem is that most people are not even interested in those independent media, and even if they have access, they wouldn't still go there.
talking about Russia, misinformation, the information war, and pertaining to Ukraine with Anton Shirikov. He's a researcher, studies propaganda and misinformation at UW-Madison. You can join in. Are you worried that something you read online may not be accurate, may be propaganda? How do you tell fact from fiction online? Should the U.S. be more involved in squelching the news reports from Russia? 800-642-1234 to join in. Russia's justification for fighting Ukraine has changed throughout the war, ranging from claims of an encroaching NATO to aims of denazifying Ukraine. And on that note, what justifications are the Russian government using now as it broadcasts to its people?
Yes, that's right. It has changed during the war and even since before the war. And I think right now it's a mix of saying that Ukraine, in conjunction with NATO, has been developing nuclear weapons, biological weapons, that would target Russia. And at the same time, they continue this earlier narrative that this is just to help people in the east of Ukraine, people who want to be with Russia, who are, as the government says, ethnic Russians, or rather Russian speakers, I would say. And so, and this narrative continues as well. They say that those people in those territories, they welcome us. They've been waiting for us for many years, and now we are finally there. So this imaginary joy of seeing the Russian army is also portrayed as one of the reasons that we need to be there. We need to help those people.
The connection to Nazis was really alarming, disturbing, and it just seemed outside the realm of possible. And you've written that these allegations are part of a longer pattern with Russia about Ukraine. Can you kind of explain that for us? What's going on there?
Yes. So Ukraine has been a problem for Russia for many years, in part because Ukraine had a couple of social revolutions and pro-Russian governments were toppled as a result. So Ukraine, more and more was choosing to be with Europe, to be with the West. And Kremlin didn't like it for various reasons. It doesn't want the democracy very near, especially, you know, pro-Western democracy. But it also wants to control this territory, and it doesn't see Ukraine as an independent country. So what the Kremlin did is, for many years, since I would say the mid-2000s, it's been trying to portray Ukraine as generally a friendly state that's been under the control of of people who are either paid for by the West or allied by the West, but they do not have control over the country. And this theme of fascism and Nazism, I'm not sure exactly when it appeared, probably around the time when Crimea was annexed by Russia. Mm-hmm. And even then they were saying that there are fascists there. And I think this theme of Nazis probably intensified in the past year or two. I'm not sure exactly, but they've been doing more and more about this.
We have UW-Madison political science researcher Anton Shirikov, studies propaganda and disinformation. Are you worried about propaganda promoting both Russia and Russian sympathizers? How do you define information terrorism? Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has praised Fox News for its coverage in presenting an alternate point of view. What do you make of Lavrov's rhetoric? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anton Shirikov here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger delivered an anti-war message in recent days to Russian citizens and soldiers, speaking directly to the people fed misinformation about their country's invasion of Ukraine with subtitles.
Ukraine did not start this war. Neither did nationalists or Nazis. Those in power in the Kremlin started this war.
Video courtesy of The Guardian. Still time to talk about Russia's information war. 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political science researcher Anton Shirikov with us for about 10 more minutes. Anton, before pursuing your PhD at UW-Madison, you were a journalist and editor with several Russian independent media outlets. How much do Russian citizens trust independent media?
Well, not much, unfortunately. Many people don't even know about those independent media outlets. Partly because they are only available online, and a lot of people are used to getting the news from television. Some people view this independent media as, you know, hostile, as pro-Western, because they present usually more liberal views. So there is a small group of people who are really attuned to those media, who follow them, who subscribe to them, donate them. But the majority of Russians, unfortunately, either doesn't care or doesn't trust this media.
You had mentioned earlier that Russian lawmakers approved a law criminalizing the spread of, quote, fake information that would discredit the Russian armed forces or call for sanctions against the country. What chilling effect does that have on journalists?
It definitely had a huge impact. So some of the news outlets were just blocked because of that, because they were set to promote this so-called disinformation about Russian army. So this was the reason to close down or to block most of them. And some others continue, but they are subject to, you know, essentially censorship. So they don't say the word war. They censor other words that are related to this operation. And I think also people are afraid to talk to journalists about this. Mm. I think this is also a huge problem.
So what about the two leaders, President Putin and Zelensky, and how they are portrayed in the media? Can you explain a little bit how Russians see Putin and how we're seeing Zelensky portrayed?
Yes. So there is a huge difference in the Russian media, at least if we look at state media. So Putin is shown as this basically lone hero, as a protector of the motherland. The guy who, you know, stands against the world to protect Russia and Russians. But as for Zelensky, what they're trying to do is they're trying to portray him as this very insecure, weird person. They've even published some sort of a psychological commentary on his state, and some so-called experts talked about Zelensky being probably a drug addict and not controlling himself. So, and this is in line with this idea that the government of Ukraine are Nazis who are drug addicts. Hmm. So it's very different.
What about social media in all of this? You mentioned that a Russian court has banned the parent company of Facebook and Instagram, Meta, for, quote, extremist activities, making their work in Russia illegal. But apparently the decision excludes WhatsApp. What is the role of social media in these times?
I think the role of social media is rather huge. So a lot of people, millions of people are using Facebook, Instagram. I would say that not all of them are interested in political news, but still when you're on Facebook, you still have access to your friends who might be against the war, might be posting something against the war. So I think this is one of the main channels that Russians could right now use to get this independent commentary. So and obviously that is why those media were blocked. As for WhatsApp, this is a curious thing. I think it is, it's not blocked yet because it's a messenger that's very widely used in Russia, and people will be upset if they lose this means of communication, even government officials. So I think they're cautious about WhatsApp, but it might be next at some point.
So if you're Silicon Valley, are you concerned that your platforms aren't available to Russians, or is this something that you knew all along that this would happen?
I think they probably could have expected it. Maybe not now, but there is China that blocks all Western social media.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's a huge surprise to them that Russia tries to do that too. And I think right now it's not a complete disaster yet, because still most people who were using Facebook were still able to access it, or at least are still able to access it. But it could change in the next few weeks. So there might be more strict blocking. And but still, even given that Russia is not such a huge market as China or India, for example. So I think they are worried, but probably it's not the main problem for them right now.
So you had mentioned WhatsApp being a popular messaging platform. What about the role of Telegram in this war and the messaging app Telegram? What do you see there?
Telegram, it's Russian. It's basically the Russian messenger, similar to WhatsApp, but it also has this more public-oriented part, I would say. So there are public channels that were basically like Facebook pages that people could use. And Telegram has become more popular since the war started, because it's not blocked, and it's not clear it will be blocked pretty soon or anytime soon. Partly because there are lots of propaganda channels on Telegram that the government supports, and they push this anti-Ukrainian stuff. But at the same time, there are also a number of independent channels on Telegram where the independent media that were blocked can mm-hmm. still use Telegram to promote their news. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword for the Kremlin. On the one hand, Telegram is important for them to push propaganda and to as a means of communication. But at the same time, they know that there are independent media on Telegram and people can access them as well. So I think there is tension here, and which means that Telegram would not be blocked soon. But again, if the situation becomes really difficult, then it might be on the table as well.
Anton Shirikov with us, researcher, EW Madison Studies, Propaganda and Misinformation. You can join in 800-642-1234. I want to ask you, Anton, about Fox News primetime host Tucker Carlson amplifying Russian propaganda. And a journalist from Mother Jones disclosed a Kremlin memo to Russian media outlets that was dated March 3rd, saying it is essential to use as much as possible fragments of broadcasts of the popular Fox News host Tucker Carlson, 12-page document. What are your thoughts here on the role of Fox News, on the role of Tucker Carlson?
So I would say Fox News has been used before. And in general, the Russian government, when they see someone criticizing the West, some journalist or some politician, they just jump on it and they promote it on their television. And with Tucker, I think the issue was that most people, even Sean Hannity, other hosts, sort of were... basically, they understood that this is aggression and we have to stop it. But Tucker Carlson still continued to promote this disinformation that is essentially Russia planted about bioweapons, about Ukraine being a corrupt and unimportant country. And so obviously this is their ally. Once the anchors on state TV said he's basically a colleague, because he's saying what they want to say, what they want to tell Russian audience. So they are very eager to use him.
I want to close here in our last moments together. As you look ahead at the information war, at the level of control imposed by the Russian government over information, and hearing from President Biden warning of a Russian cyber attack in the U.S., what are you watching for next?
I would say in terms of the war or in terms of the propaganda operations?
In terms of the propaganda operations specifically.
I think it would just continue on the same scale. I think they would try to invent even more ridiculous stories about Ukrainians, doing terrorist acts against Russia or even in Russia. Or that Ukrainians are using, chemical weapons in Ukraine. So I think stories like that would be probably next because they are out of stories right now, so they could invent something even wilder.
Anton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Anton Shirikov, PhD researcher, UW Madison, focusing on misinformation. Stay with us as we talk with the project manager of the Nature Conservancy behind the purchase of thousands of acres of forests and wetlands in central Wisconsin. How do you feel about the acquisition in the Central Sands region? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the Nature Conservancy's habitat conservation projects in Wisconsin and its recent land acquisition in the Central Sands region. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here in Wisconsin, this global environmental nonprofit says it protects more than 240,000 acres of lakes, forest land, rivers, and prairies. Should the state be setting aside as much land as possible for conservation efforts? What do you want to know about the priorities and activities of the Nature Conservancy? 800-642-1234. Stephanie Judge is a conservation project manager for the Nature Conservancy. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, good morning. Take us to these 33,000 acres of forest and wetlands in Adams County. What does it look like? What do these tracts of land appear to look like?
Yeah. And it was 3,243 acres. Mm-hmm. And this land that we purchased is located in a part of the state known as the Central Sand Plains. And it gets that name because almost 20,000 years ago, this area was covered by Glacial Lake, Wisconsin. And when that lake suddenly drained, it left behind this nearly level plain of sandy soils. And if listeners have spent time in this area, they also likely notice the really unique exposures of eroded sandstone bedrock that forms these buttes and mounds and bluffs rise hundreds of feet out of that sandy plain. So we purchased 3,243 acres total at five different sites in Adams County. And the largest of these sites is 1,920 acres, and it's immediately north of Quincy Bluff and Wetlands State Natural Area. And, I love visiting state natural areas like Quincy Bluff, because these special sites give us outstanding examples of Wisconsin's natural heritage and are some of the last refuges for rare plants and animals. And if you visit Quincy, you'll notice that the landscape is much more open than you tend to see around Wisconsin these days. And that's because it's regularly managed with controlled fires. Hmm. And so like areas of Quincy Bluff State Natural Area, most of Adams County was historically covered in a habitat known as barrens. But barrens weren't bare. These are vast open expanses of prairies filled with a huge diversity of wildflowers and grasses and shrubs like blueberries and huckleberries and hazelnuts. And then amid these open expanses, there would be savannas or island-like groupings of pine or oak trees. And the area is also interspersed with lots of wetlands, which are really important nurseries for so much of our wildlife. So this land we bought has over 500 acres of wetlands, and it also has remnants of barrens vegetation, including flowers like lupin. And, I think most listeners probably know how critical milkweed is to monarch butterflies.
Yes.
Their caterpillars can't survive without it. And lupin is to our endangered Karner blue butterfly, like milkweed is to monarchs. Karner blue butterflies, caterpillars need lupin in order to survive. And so in order to restore the species, we need to get more lupin back on the land. And that's really in part where this project comes in. Most of the land we just purchased is planted to rows of red pines, yet rare and declining species of plants and animals are hanging on in the shade of those trees. And so that's where we see a real opportunity for restoring the land to help mitigate the loss of our natural heritage and also help to adapt to climate change.
It's interesting, too, because the contrast I'm hearing you say between Quincy Bluff and these tracts of land, which are mostly red pine cultivated for logging, how long will the transition take for these pieces to look noticeably different, for the vegetation and biodiversity to change?
You know, anything like this, especially on this much land, takes time. And yeah, like you indicated, these lands were largely planted to rows of red pine. And so right now we're really focused on developing restoration plans for the site. So we'll really be working on this over the course of this season. And when we're thinking about restoring a site or enhancing its native diversity, like we did at Quincy in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources, we really look at what we've got that's good and ultimately work to maintain it. And then we begin to thin and remove what's not. And so, like I said, we really need to see what's on these properties. You know, some of these pine plantations are 15 years old. Others are 30 or more. And some have a great number of species still present, like lupin. I saw an orchid on one of the tracks the first time I walked there. You know, other areas are more denuded in like tree farms. So it's going to take some time. It's going to take years as we start to thin out this red pine and naturalize the cover and diversify the forests where we'll keep forests and then otherwise open it up to those more open grassland landscapes like I spoke about in the beginning.
I wonder how you know what you've got. I mean, is it about flying drones over the area? Is it about walking these tracts of land? How do you know how and where to cultivate what?
It's sort of a jigsaw puzzle, you know, and we sort of sometimes in land management, we talk about it as managing as like a shifting mosaic, particularly when you're talking about forests like this. So, you know, we have GIS files that show the existing stands of trees, right? Like, you know, these were crop grounds basically for growing red pine specifically. So, you know, we start with that. We'll be hiring a forest services company to really help analyze how to stagger harvests strategically. You know, some harvests will ultimately have commercial value, others will have zero value. And so it's a strategic thing. Now, you know, so I was just recently on the properties in February before we closed. And even with snow cover, you know, I can see our native jack pine, and that's a really key species that was so common here historically, and it's still hanging on, and it can be a tree that's used commercially too. But so, like, we really want to favor jack pine, and that's something we can see. So, you know, when we get to a restoration, we might very well be thinning out most to all of the red pine, but favoring jack pine. And then I mentioned a shifting mosaic. Something like jack pine is really key to a bird called the Kirtland's warbler that actually came off of the endangered species list a few years ago. And, you know, it's really great when key species like that come off the list, because one of the reasons it came off was because restoration efforts worked. And this bird needs young jack pine on the landscape. So we'll look at where are jack pine in these stands, and then how can we manage a shifting mosaic of different age classes of jack pine to try to keep enough young jack pine on the land over a period of time. You know, and of course, it doesn't just happen on this land that we just bought. It's really, you know, hoping to work with neighbors and communities over a landscape scale to try to keep key species like that blue butterfly I talked about or the warbler on the land. So it's all a process, and we've just got to, you know, survey it really. You mentioned drones. You know, we could fly drones over. We did in the winter. That's a good way to get a sense of the scale. But it's a lot of ground truthing and walking.
Ground truthing. I want to just reintroduce you here. Stephanie Judge, Conservation Project Manager for the Nature Conservancy. They recently purchased more than 3,000 acres of forests and wetlands in central Wisconsin, Central Sands region. You can join in. Have you volunteered with nature biodiversity efforts in your area? What did you learn? Should the state be setting aside as much land as possible for conservation efforts? 800-642-1234 to join in. Stephanie, before we go further, I just want to make sure I understand. So the Kirtland's warbler, this is a songbird that lives in these young jack pines, and that building up young jack pines means also increasing the population of these Kirtland's warblers?
Yeah, yeah. So one of the reasons, you know, the Kirtland's warblers declined is they need young jack pine. And jack pine is a tree that's often very associated with fire. Fire is a natural process that most of our state experienced really regularly until the last century. And so there's lots of species like this warbler, like the jack pine tree, you know, like the Karner blue butterfly, like the prairie chicken, like, you know, in southern Wisconsin, grassland birds like meadowlarks and bobolinks, and up in the northwest barrens of Wisconsin, sharp-tailed grouse. All of these species are really dependent on the fire-adapted landscape that they evolved with. But so as that's declined, these species have declined. And so, yeah, you know, in order to have more of these species on the land to help restore their populations or keep the populations that we have, we need to try to restore our land's natural processes.
Another piece of this is the land's recreational use, the hiking, the hunting, the snowmobiling. What is that piece of what is that plan involving these tracts of land?
Yeah, you know, one of our goals whenever we buy property really is to keep the land open to the public. It's important to us that people feel welcome to get out on the land and enjoy nature. And, you know, in your introduction, you mentioned that the Nature Conservancy had protected about 240,000 acres in Wisconsin. And that's true. And so much of that land is protected in collaboration with public partners, whether it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the Department of Natural Resources, as well as private partners like other land trusts. But at this time, we own about 30,000 of those acres across Wisconsin. You know, those the other land was maybe we owned it at one point and we transferred it, we donated it, whatever. But so at this point, we own and manage about 30,000 acres across Wisconsin. And the vast majority of that land is open to the public for nature-based outdoor activities like hiking and hunting and cross-country skiing and fishing and so forth. And, you know, speaking to this land in Adams County, one of the properties, the largest one I spoke of just north of Quincy, does have a long established snowmobile trail. Mm. And as is typical when we acquire land with a snowmobile trail on it, we do like to keep that open to the public. It's a long established route. And we see that it's compatible in the winter with other activities.
The Nature Conservancy's Stephanie Judge has worked on the environmental nonprofit's recent acquisition of more than 3,000 acres of forests and wetlands in central Wisconsin. What questions do you have about the Nature Conservancy's work in acquiring land in Wisconsin to protect it from development and damage from climate change? What worries you about habitat loss in your area? What do you want to know about the Nature Conservancy's decades of involvement in preserving the central Sands region? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Stephanie Judge here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring large tracts of land in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin, recently acquired by the Nature Conservancy, that has been active in this part of the state in conservation efforts for 30 years. The purchase, it represents a significant expansion of the Nature Conservancy's holdings in our state. How do you feel about turning land that was used for logging into biodiverse habitats? The Nature Conservancy plans to have it open for public hiking, hunting, snowmobiling. How do you feel about that plan? Still time, 800-642-1234. Conservation Project Manager with the Nature Conservancy, Stephanie Judge, stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on Jeff now in Delafield. Jeff, hi. What's your question?
Yes, good morning. First of all, I think what you're doing is fantastic to answer that question in terms of making land available for the public. But my main question is within regards to forestry. I would assume that you need to engage in some sustainable forestry practices. So in so doing, how do you find markets for the those products with, you know, now that the paper industry has really declined and taken away a big chunk of that market?
That's a really, really good question. You know, it's so true that timber markets have changed dramatically in recent years. But, you know, even though paper markets have declined, we do still need lumber. So that's good. You know, building materials are a product that's being looked for. One of the biggest challenges we do have, candidly, in land restoration across the state, whether on this property or elsewhere, is that we don't have great markets for small diameter woods. For example, if we're going to be taking red pine trees off of these lands over time, there might be commercial value in the main tree, but then what do you do with all the branches? Hmm. And that's the same in the southern part of the state where we've got a lot of invasive brush like honeysuckle or buckthorn. So we're really interested in exploring opportunities for using those small diameter woods. And that's something that's ongoing. I think a lot of different people are working on it. But, you know, sometimes restoration costs money and that can be prohibitive. And that's why, you know, when I indicated that this takes time and we need to be strategic, you know, some of these harvests will have commercial value, others won't, because, you know, if some of these red pine stands, you know, are actually really suppressed themselves. They're not particularly healthy. They were sort of planted and left alone, so they didn't go through their appropriate thinnings. And so that creates this situation where it's just this very dense stand of vegetation that we're going to try to go in and weed out these red pine trees that are not particularly healthy in of themselves. And then, as I said, just try to open it up. And, you know, what this does, despite it also sometimes costing money, it also can save money in the long run, right? Because when we are thinning out our forests strategically, we're not only making them more healthy for diversity, we're also lowering the risk of wildfire. Opening them up and, you know, ensuring that they also are going to regenerate better, because when our forests get so dense, you know, new seedlings can't regenerate and so forth. And so it's sort of this bad cycle. And then I would just say too, that, you know, these lands aren't going to be closed down. We haven't decided exactly what will remain in long-term timber production, but some might remain in sustainable production. The difference is that as we thin out these red pine, you know, the forests will be healthier and more diverse and multifunctional. And when we have more diversity on the land, whether it's in a forest or in a prairie, we know that that land is more adaptable to climate change.
You, Jeff, thank you so much for that question. And you mentioned restoration costs money, and the, mm-hmm. the records show that this land acquisition, this purchase in Adams County, it cost $3.5 million. So how is the Nature Conservancy funded in order to make these types of acquisitions?
The Nature Conservancy uses a whole range of different funding sources. In this particular case, we were able to purchase the property thanks to generous gifts from our donors to our recently completed fundraising campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a rare situation to be in. Other times we apply for public grants, and it really just depends on the property and, you know, the particular project and our goals for it.
Talking with Stephanie Judge, Conservation Project Manager for the Nature Conservancy, and looking at these 3,000 acres of forest and wetlands in central Wisconsin. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We heard from Cole in Kenosha, email to ask how they can find a Nature Conservancy program. Cole would like to volunteer and learn more about projects like this in the Central Sands region. Where can Cole find resources for similar projects in their area?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for asking that, Cole. We absolutely love to have volunteers, as do our partners. You know, and I think volunteering, I mean, that's really how I got started in my job, right? Like some of my first days out on the land were with an organization called the Prairie Enthusiasts, just a fabulous organization that works across part of Wisconsin and some of the adjoining states. So I think, you know, wherever you are in the state, you know, if you can find opportunities a couple of different ways. One simple way would just be to think about a park or preserve near you and, you know, Google like something like ecological restoration work party for that particular park. You know, a statewide group that has volunteer work days with no experience required is the Ice Age Trail Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say there's a lot of different opportunities if you just spend a little bit of time online, think about where you want to be. Our website is nature.org/Wisconsin. And we do offer volunteer opportunities at certain sites. We're not yet set up to have volunteer work parties at this land that we just purchased. We're, as I said, really in an analysis and in a planning phase for the restoration. But we, you know, we love to have people join us and other partner groups of ours across the state.
I think I just heard a virtual round of applause for the prairie enthusiasts. So good to hear that, Stephanie. Let's go to Gary now in Bosco Bell. Gary, hi, what's on your mind?
What's on my mind is I've been a lifetime member of the Prairie Enthusiast since the 1970s and starting in Greene County. And I wanted, because we are property managers also, and the main goal of our efforts is to protect native biodiversity, rare plant species, insect species, bird species. And I'm wondering how the Nature Conservancy is going to go about this job. Of the big job is simply inventorying this property to see what's there, and then there's so little information on how to manage for individual species that are extremely rare. How are you going to go about this process so you know, you're not strictly managing for forest product, but you're managing for habitat for probably dozens and dozens of rare and endangered species on this property? It's a terribly big job, and I'm perplexed as to how we can do it on small properties. So,
Gary, thank you. Yes, great questions there. Stephanie?
You know, it is a great question, and it's complicated, right? Like, I don't want to make it out that this is simple, and yet we know that taking key steps moves things in the right direction. And so, you know, the best we can do is take those early steps first to get this on the right trajectory, right? It's a stepwise process. So, you know, and I keep talking about removing red pine. I should say that, you know, red pine is native to central Wisconsin. However, it's near the southern end of its range, which means most red pine are found to the north. And so what we're really starting to think about too with restoration is really starting to think about climate resiliency. And so we know that in central Wisconsin, it's just going to probably be too hot for red pine to be healthy there. So that's one reason to start thinning it out. And we just know that as we start thinning out trees that and other plants, invasive plants, right, that didn't grow in a given place historically, as we reintroduce natural processes like fire, we make that land healthier, right? We increase its resilience to climate change. We help it mitigate climate change by sequestering more carbon with deep-rooted prairie plants and so forth. So it's not an easy thing, and it's going to be a stepwise process. So we will look for the opportunities to do certain areas of clearing. We'll be inventorying, you know, where is the lupin, where are the jack pine, where are other rare species, and where are the best opportunities to keep them. But some of these lands will very well be in pine plantations for years to come. We just know that there will be a plan to move them in the right direction.
Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Stephanie Judge is a conservation project manager for the Nature Conservancy. And for disclosure, the Nature Conservancy is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead, we dig into the politics and policy of criminal justice with a UW sociologist and a staff writer for the Marshall Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.